Paul Mixon from Corporate Eye. Today I'm down at the group interviewing Mark Hill and Frank Harkin. Let's start, Mark, with a little introduction. Tell us about the company, your focus, your market, what makes you different.
First of all, thank you for inviting us to speak. We're flattered. We design and build, host, manage, develop, if you like, large corporate websites. That's our game. We've been doing it for a long time. So we started in 95, and things have changed a bit since then. So we know a little bit about what we're doing, and we try to stick at it. And I guess the difference between us and other agencies is pretty small, to be honest with you, but we just work hard at what we're trying to do, which is to specialise in this particular area.
But you do have some of the top sites in terms of the ones that you've built, and so you're working a little harder as being, I think, quite successful, to be honest, in terms of the results, the end results that we see.
Yes, but there are a lot of good agencies, and yes, we happen to specialise in it, we've got a long track record, and yes, we have done well, but there are also a lot of good sites out there, and a lot of good sites done by in-house teams, which people tend to overlook. So there are a lot of high-quality corporate sites, and we have got some good ones, yes, but there's lots out there.
Let's then start off initially talking about the shortfalls that you see in terms of the key areas where people could develop a lot better sections on their sites or do a lot more.
There are quite a lot of ideas about where corporate websites will go. The most obvious one is that eventually corporates will get social. Frank's published some research on social media in terms of its take-up by FTSE 100 companies.
And we've been doing this for a year, actually, and that was going off last year. We've been looking at the FTSE 100 and how they're using Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and corporate blogging. And we found over there's been an upward trend, generally, with all of these channels over the last year, particularly Twitter. I think that makes sense. Twitter is easy to use, and it's a pretty foolproof way of getting your message out there. And it's easy to set up, and we have about 45% of the FTSE 100 are using Twitter at the moment.
Did you look at what way they're using Twitter, whether it's just broadcasting or whether they're actually interacting?
Yeah, we did. We're blogging more about, I think the first set of research was very much raw numbers, but we will be looking at best practices and doing well. There's not, but yeah, there's a huge discrepancy actually across the companies that are using Twitter and the other channels, and who's doing well, who's not doing well. There is a tendency for companies to feel like all they need to do is set something up and send out press releases. But you were doing that, but others see an opportunity to kind of talk to people. BA have a very good Twitter account, for example, and responded very well during the snowpocalypse to people's questions. And I think, you know, it's a nice way to talk to people. It's very quick, it's very easy, and if you put, I think with social media you get what you get out of what you put into it, and I think BA put a lot into it.
I think it'll work. I mean, we're seeing a few companies, like Sainsbury's and so on, starting to make the effort to outreach to the bloggers, to interact with them more as well, and so the initial use of social media and they're starting to see who has influence and so on is starting to make people see opportunities. Whereas I think maybe before they didn't see, you know, just say, oh, you could tweet, they didn't necessarily see that there was what the opportunity was.
We follow a model which is integrate social media into your corporate site, monitor it, and then engage. And a couple of our clients have been very successful at it. Centrica have got a big corporate blog. SAB Miller have got a big corporate blog. And SAB Miller used their corporate blog very effectively in December to discuss the issues that were being put to them by an organisation called ActionAid. And they were accusing SAB Miller of dodging tax. SAB Miller had the platform to respond, and did, and articulated their case very powerfully. And they also used, actually, social media widely, because they've got a Facebook account, and they've got Twitter, and they've got a YouTube channel. So that's, a living, breathing example of a corporate that successfully used social media in a communication sense in a crisis. Now, as things go forward, there'll be more and more of these types of events where crisis communications requires a social media communications strategy. So corporates are going to have to get used to it. A lot of them are, but not enough, and not quickly enough. And people forget, you know, the big numbers here. You've got 2 billion internet users globally. You've got 600 million of them on Facebook. You've got another 600 million of them on Tencent, which is the Chinese equivalent of Facebook. The world expects corporates to have conversations online, and they're not ready to go there yet, to be honest with you.
What's holding them back, do you think?
Well, they're big companies. By definition, the change is something they don't particularly like. They haven't got where they are today.
Yeah.
By jumping on every bandwagon, so I think that's definitely, I think changing big companies is something that's quite a difficult thing to happen. But I think it will.
They're also worried, naturally enough, about compliance. And they're worried about governance. They don't understand how these mediums work in a broad sense. They're on a big learning curve, and some of them are, you know, reaching for it quite quickly, and some of them just saying, no, we're not interested. And in some cases, you know, it's completely appropriate not to be too aggressive here, but we do want people to get hold of these four main mediums: their own corporate blog, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. That's the big four. They need to organize themselves around that. For some people, it's purely about getting hold of their URLs. So if I'm a large corporate and I haven't grabbed and controlled my Facebook space, at least controlled it.
Yep. They need to brand jacket. You know,
exactly.
The way we go.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
So, you know, they do need to control these spaces, even if they don't use them very much at all. That's our approach. You need to get hold of these things. You need to monitor what's happening. And we do monitoring for our clients, and the stuff that you find is truly staggering. Corporates don't realise how many conversations are going on about them in the world. They just have no vision of it whatsoever, is my gut feeling. Until you show it to them, they don't get it.
So, and what sort of tools do you use for that?
We use a tool that's built by Alterian. It's called SM2. It's very good. Got 7 years worth of data in it. Collects a lot of stuff. It's a very intelligent search engine.
Mm.
We back it up with our own because we use some other search engines. For example, we take stuff from Daylife, and we're interested in complementing the SM2 data. There are tools out there, and we put the stuff in front of our clients, and they can react. The last part of it is where you choose whether or not to engage. SAB Miller chose to engage, did it very effectively, and they did it on their own platform. Doing it on their own platform, not out there in the wild on somebody else's platform, very important. Stops people from impersonating you, for example. That's our model for social media. Will corporates get it? Yes, they will. Will they get it quickly? No, they won't. But it's coming, whether they like it or not.
And do you think, is it the combination of success stories and scare stories that will move them on? from the US or something. Yeah, you saw. I don't know if you saw the problems that Vodafone had with their hashtag, and it was well meant, well thought through. But suddenly, this issue rose up where people wanted to throw mud at them. So, and the cautionary tales are useful as long as they happen to everyone else to help guide people how to use it, how to exploit it, as well as obviously needing the positive tales.
Yeah.
I don't think social media irons those things out. It's just a medium.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop people doing things you don't want them to do. So, I mean, I think social media reflects business. It doesn't change it, you know.
I would probably challenge that. I think that the way that it can, you know, you look at BP, what happened around Gulf of Mexico, the speed with which campaigns developed.
Yep.
I think that does force changes back on the organisation in terms of the ability to, or the need to make decisions and respond quickly.
No, I think so, I agree with that, but I mean, it doesn't change people. It doesn't.
Yeah.
You still need people responding quickly, you still need people making the right decisions, doing sensible things, doing clever things. Social media gives them, it makes a big difference in terms of speed, it makes a big difference in terms of the amount of people you can reach. But it doesn't, you still need people, you still need that base, you still need to be a well-run company, you still need to have people making clever, good decisions.
Your point is well made, that corporates are sitting there having to invent new processes, new governance models, find people who know about social media, somehow put them into their comms departments, and figure out how to use all this sort of stuff. Not easy. Not easy at all. And certainly not easy to do quickly. But that's what we're seeing. We're seeing communications teams changing. And people are bringing in people who have experience of social media. That's what we expect to evolve. And the other thing that will happen is that it will be a little bit of a generational thing.
Yep.
There's no two ways about that. There are some old dogs, and you're not going to teach them new tricks. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's the way of the world. However, related to this whole issue of blogging and social media is another hurdle for corporate sites, and that is around transparency. And transparency, you know, as Mark Hines was very articulate in pointing out in your recent interview, is a big issue for corporates. And this is the age of WikiLeaks, and you have a lot of people out there who have got agendas. Whether they are trusting of corporates is a question that I have. But however, I look at social media and corporate blogging as a way in which to bring transparency and, if you like, authenticity to corporate communications. And I think that there will be a demand for this. And people will want to see chief executives blogging, telling their story personally. And they will want this authenticity. One of the challenges, if you like, is that corporate websites do need to help bring this idea to the fore. But they also need to wrap around that all sorts of other tools that help to bring transparency to everything they do. Mark Hines was talking about XBRL. That is what I call a transparency tool. That's a very important step. Bring it on quickly, please. That would be great. I'm also looking at integrated reporting. Integrated reporting is a transparency tool. It's about showing, if you like, the world that you're real about these things. Transparency is a challenge.
Do you think that with that integrated reporting thing, it will give a model that people will genuinely be able to give more detail and be more open? Or is it something where people will take it as another formula, like the combined code, and go through the tick list going, yep, we've now done integrated reporting, here's our bit of stuff on risk and governance for each section and so on? Will they actually genuinely embrace it?
There's a spectrum of responses. Some companies are very good at explaining what they do, why. Their vision for the world, their values, what they're doing in a sustainability sense, in a corporate responsibility sense. Some companies are very good at it, and it is part of their DNA.
And who would you pick out as?
Oh, like SAB Miller again. I keep giving them a name check. But, I mean, they, you know, you just look at the way that sustainability is built into their business model and their brand. Take it from me, they're very good at it. So I'm interested in integrated reporting, not per se, but because when you have a good company that has a good story to tell and uses that, it will bring power to that communication. That's all. That's the way I look at it. Will it be, you know, taken up quickly by a lot of people? No, I don't think it will be. And I think there's a lot of people who are still stuck in the Stone Age and only use sustainability reporting as they pay lip service to it. Mm-hmm. It is a tick box approach, and there's a lot of that stuff, but that's not going to live forever. The reality is, in this age of WikiLeaks and this age of, you know, people who have very little trust in institutions of any sort, government, corporations, the media, it doesn't matter, just sustainability, transparency will be absolutely crucial to the way in which you build your brand equity with all these audiences.
And how do you make it real? In this age of spin, you know, where you have nicely crafted welcomes or bits of text from the chairman, which may have been written for them, how do you actually then get it so that people make the site, make the content, get the message so that people actually believe in it and believe that the company is living its words, is being transparent, is being open and honest?
Well, their actions have to reflect their words. That's the first thing. If you don't behave in a way in which you're representing yourself, then that's it. You've broken credibility. How do companies do it? I wish I knew. But there are some companies that are very good at it and where authenticity is natural. I personally think that successful corporate websites in the future will have many voices, and they will have many voices in terms of conversations that go on through blogs. They'll have many voices in terms of people, customers, people who have experience of this business talking about it on the site or in the ether. And I do believe that, you know, you're going to see, if you like, a word of mouth become digital, and that's that it'll become real. But that's a wee way off for people to either be able to measure or articulate. Well, I would say, but that's where this will go.
And following on from that, I mean, one of the key areas, which I think is one probably the least popular, inspires you to lose the will to live the most quickly, is the corporate governance area is one where it has come from a history of tick boxing, saying, here's our standard stuff. And yet, over the last 3 years, through all the soul searching, through what went wrong, through the economic crisis, what triggered it, governance issues, ethics issues, risk issues, and so on, I don't see them changing, the governance sections changing that fast. I see there are some companies who have hit real crises, like Siemens with their fraud issue with their directors, mm-hmm. really responded very, very well mm-hmm. in the way that they talk about how they've now embedded ethics through mm-hmm. their culture. UBS are very, very good on the executive remuneration side, the tone mm-hmm. they've set through successive years,
yep.
having had a bit of a spanking through what went wrong. And to my mind, I see the need to actually, in something like the combined code and now the new governance code, people to actually embrace the real spirit of it. So, you know, with non-exec skills, being able to demonstrate the aggregate skills they've got, the specific skills, the specialist skills, and demonstrate they genuinely can connect and give oversight to the business mm-hmm. and the risks through that. But I think that is still a little way off.
Risk, you're really talking about risk and communication. My take on corporate responsibility, should I say, and the content that's in there are many issues about this. The way we look at it is there are many companies who treat this as a silo. So when you're talking about governance or risk or sustainability or responsibility, they'll have a section. It's not part of the DNA of the rest of the site, for example. So when people talk about process, about risk, about sustainability, they have to talk about it everywhere. So it does have to be part of the fabric of the site and the content. But I think when I look around at the good corporate sites, more and more corporates are looking at the sustainability angle, if you like, of their comms as part of their brand. And this is the challenge, I think this is the problem or an issue that many corporates face, is that they're having to figure out where this responsibility stuff fits and how it should be articulated as part of their story. And some companies are successful at it and some companies are struggling. As far as the processes that go to put together, you know, good governance models, good risk management models, I see that kind of content being very, very important in terms of the investor relations area, for example. You know, many investors are looking around now and saying to themselves, okay, we've got many ways in which we're exposed to risk. How does this company mitigate it? How does it control it? Who's responsible for it? You know, I see a clear articulation of these areas being more important than necessarily the need to report against regulation. But however, it's an area where companies are patchy in terms of what they talk about. So.
And I think in terms of how you present that on a corporate website, one of the buzzwords in 2010 in content, that's what I do, has been content curation and this idea that there's tons of content out there. And part of a content strategist's job is to kind of curate that, and people often use the prior museum metaphor, but I think it rings true. And I think an area like corporate governance is probably right for that, because often this stuff is on one page, on an investor page, in the investor relations section, and it's one page, and they just chuck it on, like, very obviously done. And actually, on your site, there was a very good example of, I think it was a Chinese export company, and they'd actually done that, but they chucked everything on one page. But what they'd done was they'd given so much information that if you delved into it, in terms of transparency, in terms of finding out how this company deals with governance issues. It was all in there, but it just wasn't curated. It wasn't it wasn't brilliantly presented. So there's how you present this information. I think you need to have a depth of information, but you need to present it to people properly. There's also third-party stuff you can put in. You could have somebody from Transparency Matters, for example, talking about your governance, giving a contextual information about how you present governance. You can post stuff in from Twitter. You could really think about your corporate governance section and curate the content in a way that gives you credibility.
Having looked at what at the BP thing, where before Gulf of Mexico, some of the features they had in how they explained risk were very good, visual, but actually the base risk management section hadn't really changed year on year. So there's a time element, but I think there's also an element of saying, looking at your worst case scenarios and what's the worst that could happen, and linking it to crisis management and crisis readiness and so on. There's a whole set of things that actually then immediately, it's not just about communications, but it actually changes the business. But there is a demand created by crises and events that are played out in public, like Gulf of Mexico, which then makes you think, well, then they should be talking about this and this and this.
Well, crisis communications online has to be absolutely perfect these days, and BP was a classic example. Companies have to be prepared now, with very short notice, to be able to launch either sections or microsites that deal with powerful issues that they face, whether they're accidents or events or disasters or acquisitions or whatever it turns out to be. And that's a, if you like, an area where we're seeing companies spend a lot of time and effort. Crisis comms and the use of the online medium is absolutely knitted together.
And how would you say BP did performed?
Not fantastically, to be honest with you.
Talking from an online perspective as opposed to, obviously there, we can talk a lot about the whole background.
There's nothing that the online world can do for you if, at the top, people make tactical or strategic errors about leading the comms message. I don't look at the BP situation as a good or a bad online experience. I look at it as a comms experience. In my view, anyway, there were errors made very early on about how to respond to that crisis, and that really affected everything that flowed. Mm. It was just made very early on. In terms of this, just talking about content just for a second, one of the things that people don't think about enough is the use of video online.
Agreed.
And in these days of many words and short attention spans, the power of video is immense on corporate sites. And not enough corporates are looking at their sites and saying to themselves, we're kind of a mini TV channel. And they need to think about themselves like that. Across our sites, video is very, very popular. And if you only have to look around you, YouTube, you're looking at 35 hours of video being loaded up every minute. So this is a video generation. Corporates have to get there, and they have to figure out how to get this stuff curated, as Frank points out, and put it on site, and do it quickly and reasonably cost effectively.
Because that's one of the things, I think, having started off, their introduction to video was probably through a Cantos or something like that, a very well rehearsed, very high quality. Mm. But then they had that price point stuck in their heads,
yes.
I think. And I think that's what's kind of held them back.
Yes.
Whereas you see some companies now with their own in-house video departments, or you can do great things by crowdsourcing with the employees to come up with actually very good stuff and get them to vote on it on what's most popular and so on.
The use of video will grow and grow and grow. And I personally don't think that corporates are relaxed enough about the need for a high-quality production finish to a video. Would I value authentic communications from the project manager who's sitting in Iraq digging gold out of the ground and talking about how he is helping to build a village school? Yes, I would. I want to have that authentic kind of feel come through from on-the-ground communications from from your suppliers, from your customers, from your own people? Yes, I do. Does that have to be highly finished? No, it doesn't. But I think that's a losing battle. Everybody wants to have highly finished stuff. I'm just hoping that gradually fades, because speed and cost just mean that's impossible.
Yeah.
So give people, teach them how to use the video camera, teach them how to frame things, use training, but don't expect to fly a video crew to Iraq once every 3 months and film something that's just out of the way, completely impossible. So that's where we see things going, and we also see it as a very powerful tool for senior management to give their vision of the business and where it's going, and that's not done nearly enough. What's your strategy? Where are you going? How are you going to get there? Those kinds of things always come best personally in video, and you should be videoing this.
Absolutely.
But so that you just see the whites of their eyes. That's what video does, and it's extremely popular across our sites. So we just see time. You know, when you find that the average user spends 12 minutes on a corporate site, corporate sites are not a bundle of laughs. You're not going there for the entertainment, but video keeps people there, and it retains their attention, and they get more. They definitely get a very clear idea of who you are and what you stand for.
And the stats for reuse of video, the likelihood of people actually writing about the key message you want to give, is far higher.
Yeah.
The stats we've seen for video, when you've got video that can be embedded elsewhere.
Yeah.
So thinking about making sure that the content or the info snacks that you've put in, or the video chunks, can be reused and can roll out or referenced or shared.
Yes.
Is as important, I think, as just getting it on.
And that's why people need to control their YouTube space. It's about reusing the videos they already have on the corporate site and sticking them there. And it helps, if you like, to bring awareness of your message to those people on YouTube, but also it'll bring traffic back to the site. So all that stuff is good. Video is going to be big.
Note to self, get a video camera. We actually have got some videoing scheduled, probably of me, but I'll invite you along next time. Let's talk a little bit about the annual report and the CR report, and how you see those evolving in terms of their usage and relative.
This is an easy one. I know all the arguments about print and full online HTML and flash based and image based and all that kind of stuff. Dominic Jones is very perceptive in his writings about this kind of stuff.
He doesn't like the image based ones.
Well, I don't either.
I've actually encountered one that I've enjoyed reading.
No. The simplest way of looking at it is that I want the storytelling aspect, if you like, of the report to come to the fore. And to do that, you do it best online, where you can use powerful graphics or video, or you've got a million and one tools to make things engaging and compelling. Now, if I turn around and look at an annual report printed, and I compare the book and the movie, if you like, there's no way that I'm going to sit there and say, yes, show me the book, please. No. But I'm an analyst. I want to download Excel spreadsheets. I want to use the tools that are sitting in this thing. Show me the print, did you say? I mean, it's just ridiculous. So I have been hammering on at this since 2000 or something like this, because the economics of it are just dreadful. My gut feeling is that 2,500 professional investors here in the UK cost us hundreds of millions of pounds in terms of the print costs for these annual reports. And the sooner that they're pushed online and told to print their own thing off, a PDF, the better. Economically, just dreadful. So storytelling definitely has to go online. Is that enough of a rant?
Oh, you can rant some more. But also, how do you see a lot of different ways that people are starting to integrate them into the site. So if you look at the BP site, you can transition into the annual report in a number of different ways. So through the risk section, through governance, without actually necessarily noticing, or it's not being that obvious that you've then gone into the report, which I think is a good thing in terms of reuse of material. If you've gone in, you want to learn about their risk management or whatever, you can then do that without having to go and say, oh, I remember there's probably going to be another bit in the annual report that will go there as well. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, we always want the user to know where they are. So they're in an annual report, they're in an annual report. If they're on the website, they're in the website. You're really telling me that BP couldn't be bothered to take the content from the annual report and put it into the website, which is very common. The website should actually be this main storytelling mechanism, if you like. Yeah, of course, the annual report's got a role to play, and it does. There's a lot of historical, backward-looking stuff, often, in these annual reports. And yes, you can make the information available within the site. But I just think that's just laziness.
Your view would be to give the full story on the site, and the annual report is it's an end-of-term report. It's basically saying, here's the story.
Yeah, it is at the moment.
At this point in time, blessed by the board.
It is at the moment, an end-of-term report. But remember, we're going to move gradually, slowly but surely, towards some form of pretty continuous reporting, is my guess. And you know how corporates handle that, I haven't got my head around that at all. But my take on it is you can't be sitting there with this historical record and saying to people, yes, it should be a natural part of the corporate website experience. Take the content from that report, put it into the website itself and make it real and make it integrated and seamless, but don't go shooting them off to the annual report and slightly confusing them. Is this the risk policy this year or last year, or where am I? I mean, why would you raise those questions? That's not in the user's mind. So.
Because it was an interesting discussion that I had with Benevis from Sainsbury's about their CR report and how initially they created their online CR report and had that as their CR section. And then as they themselves have started to obviously a lot of those stories get updated through the year. People want to know, well, what's happened to your initiative on this, that and the other. And also a move to quarterly reporting of their sustainability stats. So that has been an interesting real journey for them as they realise that you need to have ongoing news about sustainability. Yes, you can have your end-of-term report, but you've got to make it a lot more living and breathing part of the site.
And this is the issue that many corporates are grappling with, is in fact they're doing tons of stuff each quarter, each 6 months, each year, that needs to flow into the website. In the CSR stuff, there are all sorts of activities. People want the news. They want to know what's going on. They want this. It's not a matter of building a CSR section saying, here are our policies, here's how we have a go at things. And by the way, you can pop over here and see the report. No, it's a continuous reporting of your activities. So that, for me, is a no-brainer, and people should be doing it. In a related sense to this, investor relations areas of corporate sites are also in need of, if you like, an injection of thought. Too many corporate sites have investor relations sections which are anemic collections of historical documentation and presentations and regulatory filings and news and the share price, and that's it. I'm quite interested in corporates that take the investment case and make it very, very easy to understand for investors. And who present that in a way in which is engaging, compelling, and complete, and which uses, brings together resources that the investor or the analyst wouldn't be able to easily find themselves. And the number of companies that do not present their investment case online is truly staggering. And this is the lost opportunity in terms of having a proper valuation of your company, to me, is breathtaking. Why would you have all this stuff there, and then say, you, Mr. Investor, put that all together yourself. Good luck.
Indeed.
And it's just mind-boggling. And then they don't bother to actually even say, if you like, put the chief executive front and centre, expressing this in a video, in a simple way. This is where we're going. This is how we're going to get there. By the way, we have a strategy. So to me, there's a lot of companies that are cheaper than they should be because people are not bothering to communicate.
Well, we saw a great example, which wasn't an explicit investment case, but it was an American industrial property company, Prologis. They went through a very bad patch, having sort of overextended themselves, investment, risk, and so on. And when the economic downturn came, they were they were left exposed. 18 months on from this problem period where the share price collapsed and they had to raise more money and so on, they were between annual reports and they made the effort to feed back to investors what they had achieved of their action plan to solve the problem. They put an extra section on the front of the website, had a piece from the CEO. They'd mapped out all the industry trends that led the indicators that showed they were improving and the ones that the fortunes of the company generally followed. They had analyst quotes saying the management had got it. They've understood what the problems were and they've reacted. They explained how they'd set themselves targets and had exceeded them for the recovery plan. And as a piece of communication, it was really good. And to my mind, one of the easiest investment cases is if you've seen that something's been very well valued before, and then it's gone through a problem and then fixed those problems, and the share price is way down, you can, and you then see all the evidence behind, then that's a great way of saying, here is an investment case. And they're not, in the States, obviously, they're not allowed to incite people to invest, but it was a pretty good model.
Yes.
And we've done a bit of a study on that. So I totally agree with you. You know, it is about the story, and the story is lacking. I see a lot of investor sections just kind of coming up to that sort of everyone's the same and they're all fairly generic, and it's going to be the thing that's going to make it stand out is the story, is that personal connection. So.
Yeah, the story is definitely, you know, without which nothing. That's where it starts. But we can go back on those issues of transparency, and we can go back and say to ourselves, okay, let's put tools here that help people to put together this information and look at our performance over a period of time. Charting tools are quite simple ways of doing this. But there are lots of ways in which people should be using and bringing innovation, if you like, into these corporate sites. For example, the experience that most people have online with, say, retail sites, lots and lots of them are very fun, they're easy, you know, easy to use, and they have a little level of excitement. You know, you have location services or flash sales or all these kinds of, you know, people have got this use, if you've got used to this idea that in fact websites should be a bit of fun. They should be easy to use. They should be a lot better than they are now. And so corporate sites, in effect, are a little bit like country cousins because they're sitting there, people are comparing corporate sites with their other experiences, and corporate sites don't come off very well. So will people have to make these corporate sites more engaging, more fun, simpler, easier to use, with better tools? Yes, they will. It's one of the reasons why we put personalization into our sites, is because people are coming to these sites. They're coming to them once or twice a month. Why would you learn? You have to learn how to run, how to find your way through a big corporate site. Even though it's got clear navigation, you have to find your way through it and find stuff. So this is personalization is a way of saying, I'm going to save that journey, I'm going to keep it, I'm going to come back to it next time, just makes it easier. And all of a sudden you've got a user who not only thinks you've thought about them, no bad thing, but who would find fewer barriers to coming back again, so they become more loyal, they get more of your messages, they actually perceive of you as if you like, a much more enjoyable and authentic experience. Mm. It reflects well on the brand. So innovation is going to become, particularly to make things fun, easy and simple, well, is something that corporate websites need to learn.
And what do you think about the impact of increased use of mobiles and mobile sites, and, you know, as you have, I know there was an article about how a third of retail sales were done through a mobile, or online retail sales were done through a mobile. It's a bit of an amazing stat.
Yep.
How do you think that will impact?
Okay, there's a lot of smartphones now, and you've seen the takeoff of the iPhone and the iPad, the famous third device. What people don't, or people forget, I think, is that, you know, there are a lot of Android phones. So the Android market share is about 25%. The iPhones is about 17%. BlackBerry about 15%. So when people come along and say, let's build an iPhone app, they're actually picking on a very small part of the population.
Yeah.
And people do need to think about mobile sites. They need to think about things that aren't specific to any one platform. And you can build app mobile sites that are light, that are that look and feel like applications, and that will do a good job for their users. So that's just one element of this. The flip side to all this mobile is that many people, many corporate sites have audiences that will use the mobile phone, and you know, simple ones, career seekers, customers. People expect now with these smartphones to be able to come to your site and find everything, and they expect it to behave gracefully. They expect the experience that they get on the mobile phone to be the same one that they would on a PC. That's a challenge for a lot of sites because they haven't been built with modern technologies. The issues about mobile in the long run, I can see that corporates are going to have to put some effort into the mobile experience. And yes, it's a no-brainer. They will have to have the same experience in both places. It's a coming thing.
And everyone's going to need to get better eyesight.
Well, you know, that's true. That's absolutely true. But you can raise the font size on these things. That, yep. You know, they're pretty good. But it's choose a platform that's neutral. Don't just jump on the iPhone app bandwagon because you think it's the thing to do.
And do you see much demand for clients saying, "Oh, we've got to have an app or some," and what sort of things?
Oh yeah, quite a lot of people are asking for apps or things like apps to do specific jobs. And you know, there are a few out there, and we're starting to build some. Actually, we've built a lot of mobile sites, but we've built a mobile site specifically to sit around things to do with the annual report. Mm. Believe it or not. That's an interesting development for us. But yes, clients are much more aware. They know what they can get on an iPhone or a BlackBerry or an Android phone, and it's very, very front of mind. Everybody's talking about apps and how they're doing stuff. So
any examples you can give us of?
Well, there's some good ones out there. There's a good one by, I think, Audi. Got a corporate iPhone app. But they haven't got one for an Android.
Yep. So GM have moments have an app as well, but it's just based on videos actually. So they pulled in corporate videos and created an app, which I imagine was quite easy. I don't know how well used it's been. People want apps, but I think you don't want to just have an app for the sake of an app, and there has to be a reason. So I think we're quite aware of that as well. If you've got an annual report, you can browse the annual report fairly easily on your iPhone or your Android. You don't necessarily need an app to go along with that. Next 15 did. Yes. And it seemed a little bit pointless.
What was the annual report site that you did? Mobile site?
I can't. I'd have to shoot you if I told you.
The pleasures of the interview.
It'll be going live in about 2 months.
So. Well, do let us know when it goes out, and we'll
consider it a data.
One other aspect, which I kind of feel has gone off the boil, is around things like accessibility, where when I talk to clients, they just want to be better than those people down the road, but the importance of it seems to have become, in their minds, as a priority, seems to have gone down compared to a couple of years ago. Do you think that's fair? What is that? So, isolated stuff that I'm picking up.
I think it might be indication. I don't know if this is an anecdotal evidence, but an indication that it's embedded more than. I think accessibility was a big deal a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, because the web was so inaccessible. I'm not saying things are brilliant now, but I think you know you've got the code, and I think certainly all of our sites are as accessible as they can be. I think we don't think massively about accessibility here. It's so embedded in what we do, it's just part of the process, is right, the content is part of the process. It's just, so it's not such a big deal, but only because it's embedded in what we do. I think that's probably something that I feel is true for the company.
But I certainly think that most sites degrade, unless they're using very good tools very regularly, you'll see a degradation in how accessible the site is because. You know, to make truly accessible PDFs, to make sure your content is structured in the right way, and that your people who are producing that base content are doing it to standards, is a hard ask.
Well, it's expensive too. That's the other thing. So, you're absolutely right. Cost has been an issue for some people. However, I do think that accessibility practices have improved remarkably over the last couple of years, and that people are aware that some simple things should work easily. Mm. You should be able to tab through the site, you should be able to download, you know, text versions of videos. All sorts of just natural, normal things are done quite widely now. There's still some areas where people are pretty sloppy. Do I see it changing? I just see it as part of, it's just about being, as Frank said, it's embedded in everybody's processes now. And clients know that they potentially stand the chance of legal challenge, so they're pretty interested in it, let's put it that way.
Let's talk about, as we move towards the end, you'll be pleased to around people's appetite for rebuilding, redesigning sites in light of the current economic climate, and whether they see the importance of online comms going up or down, or how they react, what sort of changes you're seeing in companies' behaviours as a result of that.
There's no doubt about it that rebuilds are being delayed. They are. This economic climate, if you like, has made companies that didn't have a rigorous approach to the strategy that launched their site originally. So if you didn't have a very good architecture and you hadn't thought through perhaps how the site might evolve or grow, then some people have been forced to rebuild because those issues weren't addressed right at the beginning. Companies that are slowing down that development phase or redevelopment phase can't do it for very long. You're still looking at the average age of a corporate site probably is 3 to 4 years. If you can get it to last for 4 years, you really did do a very, very good job right at the beginning. That's a hard ask. So many things happen to companies. You know, they have new products, new management, new companies get acquired, divested, all those kinds of things. So there's a lot of movement. So to make the thing hang in there and stand up is pretty tough. And corporates now are pretty aware, I think, of, you know, the importance of creating a site that can grow and can evolve and can last for 3 or 4 years without, as you put it so eloquently before, without degrading. That's pretty tricky, but it can be done.
Do you think that changes the way that companies work with their agencies at all, in that if those agencies that are sort of build once and then leave the client alone until the next rebuild comes along, versus those that work closely with them and look to develop an ongoing strategy about telling the story, are two very different approaches. And I think the way that companies need to work with their agencies and absorb all the new change that's going on needs to be much more proactive. When I would imagine you go, yep, I agree with that. But are there any sort of aspects of that about how you work with the clients or the demands they're making on you, how those demands are changing? Or
We bring a lot of research to our clients, at least annually, where we do, a review of their web analytics, their social media. We do content design, brand audits. We bring all this stuff together, compare it with their peers, look at best practice, and from that you annually come up with a roadmap for the next 12 months. Sometimes it's for the next 12 months, 24, 48, whatever it turns out to be. For us, anyway, we only work to the future. Having a long-term strategic view for these corporate sites is absolutely required. How should agencies and companies work together? I only know our model, so I can't really comment. And remember, there are some very good in-house corporates, in-house teams, and they know their stuff. There's a lot of good ones. The world isn't just about agencies, and you know, there's a spectrum of the way in which people deal with these things, and some of them are really good at it. So they're the ones we watch.
Well, I think that just about wraps it up. So, Mark, Frank, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And can I leave one plug with you?
You can.
Which is, we've got a blogging directory, and we've got an online annual reports directory, CR directory, and of course we've got a blogging platform there. We'd like people to engage in these resources, and we'd like to hold, if you like, we would like to engage in conversations with people who are interested in these areas of online corporate communications. That's our game. We want to share our knowledge and learn from other people. So bring on, come and knock on our door virtually and quickly.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.